You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, it's Saturday. It is game day for you and for me because you're having a bunch of people at your house. I'm going to go run a Pathfinder game at my friend's house. So lots of gaming happening today. But we're also recording a podcast with a guest.
We are indeed. And this is this, I mean, in the theme of games and fun and whimsy and things like this, I don't know, just every now and again, a pitch comes at me and I'm like, oh my gosh, this could go completely off the rails in the best possible way. And this is a conversation that I want to have because of it. So that's, if anybody's wondering, like, where did this booking come from? That is exactly the vibe that I'm going for here. We're giving chaos. So we have Human History on Drugs is a new release from Sam Kelly. So welcome aboard, Sam. I think the first thing that we need to ask, because it's sort of important in clarifying, is, what led you to decide this is a book you had to write?
Okay, so I've always been really fascinated by history. I mean, I graduated with a bachelor's degree in history from Stanford, but way before that, when I was a little kid in elementary school, I would ask my teacher if I could borrow the teacher's edition of the textbook so I could see all the extra fun facts and discussion questions and all that stuff on the sides. And, you know, my mom would come in the next morning and she'd see that I'd passed out on my bed with the book still open on my chest. So that's always been a big formative thing. Is that I wanted to get more than just what is conventionally taught. I wanted to really go outside the boundaries of what is conventionally taught in school. And I found that there were so many cases in which if you just pull on a thread, do a little bit of digging, it turns out that there is all this fascinating stuff about major historical figures engaged in substance use, but in most of the mainstream historiography, this gets batted away after like a sentence or two at most, as though it's not interesting. And I couldn't help but think, why are you not focusing more on this? This is incredibly fascinating. This is a missed opportunity. If you're not going to talk about it, well, by God, I'm going to talk about it because this is great.
I know why they don't talk about it. And this is salient right now, given that South Park is in the news so much right now.
Yeah.
But it basically comes down to, and this is an impersonation that comes back after cycles. It's like, drugs are bad, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's this simplistic idea that it's somehow inappropriate to talk about it. So certainly, I think it would be a lot harder to, certainly in a... I mean, nowadays, even at the university level, you might get pushback for this, but certainly in most classrooms, it would be very hard to talk about the very substantial drug use of historical figures, many of whom are highly revered historical figures. People are going to think that I'm somehow trying to impugn them or diss them or otherwise bring them down. And I'm not doing that at all. I'm saying, no, this is a true and accurate thing about their life that is really interesting. It gives a more nuanced picture of who these people were, helps explain some stuff. But some people just don't want to hear that if it messes with their image of who they have.
Yeah, no, I absolutely get where you're coming from here. So my background, I teach in a high school environment, and it's always interesting to encounter students in my context. I'm an English teacher, but history tends to intersect, and so that comes up with some frequency. And the school where I teach draws students from all over the state. And so I'm seeing sort of representatives of lots of different school districts, lots of different approaches, lots of different backgrounds. Some of them got homeschooled, some of them moved in from other states, some of them just came to the United States relatively recently. So it's just like a wide swath of how was stuff taught to these kids. And frequently, you can kind of draw that through line back to where they came from. Like, oh, you're from that district. They don't ever talk about this. Or you're from there. They don't ever do this. And I think that goes back to exactly what both of you were talking about here. This idea that we have a really difficult time separating historical figures from our feelings about them and also from the feelings of the present day. Like trying to use present day assumptions and values to judge the actions of people in the past. And that has its limitations. And I think especially when it comes to something like drug use, which we still have this extraordinarily socially complicated relationship to, it gets even thornier.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so much stigma. So it's one thing to, I think it'd be one thing to go into a classroom and talk about like even something like Hitler being a massive methamphetamine abuser and other stuff like that. Cause it's like, oh, well, Hitler was bad. Methamphetamine abuse is bad. But then especially when it gets into things where their drug use did not necessarily impact their life in a negative way or in a way that is very much open to interpretation, I feel like, yeah, there could be pushback from people who are saying, well, are you endorsing this? And I'm not endorsing this. This book doesn't exist to either glorify or demonize. It exists to share really fascinating, interesting stories.
Okay, so that's the perfect inroad for the next question. Can you give us an example of a fascinating, interesting discovery that you made that maybe like was especially unexpected for you?
Yeah. One great example that I love focusing on was that. So I knew that there were a lot of products that had ingredients that are not legally permissible now, but it was surprising to see that. So cocaine infused wine was a big thing in the 19th century. I did not expect to see Pope Leo the 13th, like not the current guy, it's Pope Leo the 14th, but the guy who the current guy is named after, his like the previous Pope Leo, he loved this cocaine wine so much that he said that, quote, it fortified him when prayer was insufficient. He gave a Vatican gold medal to the creator of this wine and appeared in a full page advertisement endorsing it. And that was all seen as completely normal at the time. And indeed, you could buy that cocaine wine in a supermarket and Queen Victoria drank it. Ulysses S. Grant drank it. Thomas Edison drank it. So it was very popular at the time. And it's actually Coca-Cola starts off as a knockoff of this stuff that later has the alcohol removed. But I just never thought that I would see a full page advertisement of a Pope endorsing cocaine infused alcohol. That was a surprise to me.
Well, if you look back at a lot of things in the past, I mean, you know, you go to your doctor and your doctor's like, you're not feeling well, you should start smoking. That'll help you lose weight. You'll feel better. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
no, absolutely. Some of the instructions on these. So again, laudanum, another big 19th century and earlier on. So it's opium as a tincture. So it's opium mixed with alcohol. And this is the kind of stuff where back then, you know, it'd be like, oh, is your baby teething? Are they having problems? Just give them a few drops of this. It'll make them calm down right away. And it was just surprising to see all these things that we think of as beyond the pale now that were totally normal for that point in time. And people just didn't think twice about it.
Yeah.
I like to tell the story. This would be the 70s, but one of my aunts, my oldest aunt, everybody's at her house for Christmas, and she hit her limit with us kids, all the kids running around. She hit the limit. So there was the spiked eggnog and the unspiked eggnog, and she just poured rum in the unspiked eggnog that the kids were drinking to knock us all out. I'm done. It knocked us all out. Like we were done for the rest of the day. Like I tell that story now and people lose their mind. They're like, oh my God, you can't do that. And she had no qualms whatsoever about doing that.
Yeah. Society marches on. So things that are seen as totally like, that's just how it's done are seen as shocking in a different age. And some things is vice versa. You know, some things are seen as shocking in a previous age, but now it's just, oh yeah, that's just a normal part of life. I definitely always thought that it was very fascinating to read about, again, so I'm in California, right? And I read about things like Timothy Leary getting brought in for a minute amount of cannabis. I think it was like two burnt out joints, so mostly just like the ends of them. And I'm thinking like, I now live in a place where I can legally go into a store and buy an ounce of this stuff, something that would have gotten like people put in prison for like a decade or more back in the day. And like, and if someone steals this, I can report that to a cop and the cop will actually be like, oh, your property was stolen, sir. Like that did not used to be the case.
And it's crazy that if the person steals that and they cross state lines, it's still a federal crime.
Oh yeah. That's still a federal crime. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the whole legal infrastructure changes so much. And so it's just really interesting to see what is commonplace in some eras and what is rare and how that changes over time.
I can top you a little bit on that because I'm in Colorado and it's legal here as well.
Yeah.
Kansas is not. And so I-70, when you're leaving Colorado and you're going through there, that little corridor is known for Kansas State Troopers pulling people over if they have a Colorado license and coming up with a reason to search the car.
Yeah, that's no good. That's a severe problem because you've got these clashing. I feel like in that case, it's almost trying to like society is kind of moving on and there's a desperate attempt to actively push it back. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Just gather some money from some extra tickets as well.
I mean, oh, yeah. It's like, who cares? They don't even live in this state, you know, like they're not even from around here. So why?
Well, remember, if it's a drug bust and if there's enough, then it becomes forfeiture of property. So they can seize a car. They can seize computers. They can seize all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's so many pretexts for these things.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
But kind of going back to your book a little bit, if you look at like the 7% solution from Arthur Conan Doyle, right, the whole thing with Sherlock Holmes, that today people go, oh my God. But back then it wasn't that unusual.
Oh, yeah. No, all kinds of stuff from the fact that Holmes just like injects cocaine into himself on a regular basis. It's like it shocks us now. But at the same time, one of the big inspirations for the book was I took Intro to Psychology like many people do. And obviously, we talk a lot about Freud's influence on the field of psychology. And so obviously, there's things like the subconscious mind that are very important for understanding how humanity works still. But at the same time, they also made points, you know, things like penis envy, the Oedipus complex, the electric complex. These things aren't really as accepted nowadays. These are seen as strange and out there. And I wonder, like, how is it this guy has such absolute confidence in these strange, out there ideas? So I'm looking at a list of his other works, and he's got something in there called Uber Coca. And I'm like, Uber coke, like coca leaves, like cocaine. And so I look at it and he has written this ode to cocaine in which Freud is saying that he believes that cocaine is a wonder drug. He believes that it is not addictive and believes that it can basically do just about anything. And so I learned from that, like, why are we not focusing more on that? Digging in, apparently for the better part of 12 years, he was on cocaine almost every day, all the time. And this was a time period where it was legal. It was a novelty. A lot of the time, he didn't have to pay for it. He could just write to pharmaceutical companies and say, excuse me, I am a respected member of the medical community in Vienna. I would like to try your product. And they would just give him free samples of medical grade cocaine. And so part of the reason why he thought that it wasn't addictive is that he never ran out of cocaine. He basically had infinite cocaine for about a dozen years, and he's working on all his theory. And it suddenly makes so much more sense why Freud has these out there beliefs that he has absolute confidence in when I realize that he's coked out for the entire thing.
Context is everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess on that theme of context, then we've talked a lot about drugs that were in use by well-known historical figures and important historical figures that continue to persist today. But surely you encountered a lot of drugs that really aren't kind of circulating anymore that were part of the lives of some historical figures. And I'm kind of curious about the process of researching that, because to a certain degree, you have to not only figure out what can be known about this person and their use of this drug, but you also have to figure out things about the drug that you might yourself not really know because it's not studied or sort of part of our kind of medical knowledge or attention anymore.
Yeah, no, there's definitely issues like that. And it does help that a lot of things are, like, again, opium in the form of opium itself is not as commonly used nowadays, but so many opioids still remain in widespread use. And similarly, a lot of other drugs that, for instance, a lot of these like 19th, early 20th century figures were big into barbiturates, which was a thing at the time. But then I think those have mostly been replaced with with benzodiazepines like Valium, Xanax, Ativan, what have you nowadays, because it turns out that the therapeutic window for them was so small. Like, it was a very small distance to go between this is medically useful and this is medically dangerous. And so because of that, there's a lot of things that have similar effects to drugs that exist now, but for various reasons were discontinued for simply being too dangerous. Like, technology marched on enough, they were able to find something healthier to replace it to. So it is rare that there was a drug that was just completely unlike everything else, but plenty of things became obsolete as better replacements were in place. And certainly it's not that some of the drugs were pretty out there, like things that I wouldn't necessarily have considered a drug to begin with. So Van Gogh ate his own paint. He would eat his paint a lot. And it just didn't occur to me to think of that as a drug, because most people are not into eating paint. I knew that huffing paint was a thing, obviously a very dangerous thing, since it pretty much just kills your brain cells. But it didn't occur to me that when I first heard that Van Gogh ate paint, I thought it was a mean-spirited joke. It's like, oh yeah, the guy who's crazy enough to cut his ear off in a fit of psychotic rage. Like, yeah, he eats paint. And I'm like, that just seems mean. And then I go to the Van Gogh Museum website, like the actual official thing, and they got an FAQ page. And one of the first questions there is, I heard that Van Gogh ate paint. Is that true? And they said, yes, he ate paint. Yellow paint was his favorite flavor. And it has details about the – and I'm like, okay, this is a legitimate thing. One time a roommate of his had to stop him from drinking a whole bottle of turpentine. So I don't really know what that would do to a person.
Nothing good.
Yeah, no, like very bad stuff. And certainly at that time, most of the paint had lead in it too. So it was even worse than eating paint nowadays, which is a crazy thing to say, because eating paint nowadays is already a terrible idea. No one should eat paint.
You go around to every kindergartner class in the country and in the world and tell them that.
Yeah, Crayola's been working real, real hard to you know, try to make it as non-toxic as possible, because man, those crumb hustlers, they want to dig in there and get, they don't even bother with the jars of paste anymore. They're just going straight to the glue sticks.
I mean, to be fair, like, people do eat these things, but you're really not supposed to. I mean, like
a pica kind of.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. Like, Van Gogh clearly had
lead poisoning.
he got lead poisoning. He clearly had pica to begin with, but it seems pretty clear that he was already severely mentally disturbed, and eating lead-based paint just made it even worse for him.
This is why it was good that Doctor Who took him to the future and showed him how important his work was before taking him back and letting him, you know, live out the rest of his life.
Yeah, yeah.
Which probably was also not in any way detrimental to his mental stability. The idea that he got taken into the future by Space Doctor with a phone booth.
But I got to say, even things like Van Gogh loves bright shades of, you know, like his paintings are filled with yellows and sunflowers and all these bright, and it's like, It does make a little bit more sense to know that he loves yellow so much that he doesn't just paint with it. He puts it in his body. Like, it's,
I wonder if it's like a synesthesia thing for him. Like, he really believed that yellow had a flavor. Like, he looks at yellow and he believes it has a flavor, and therefore I'm going to eat the yellow paint. And I don't know.
Like, yeah, no, I think it was heavily terpenes based. Like, the paint had a powerful odor, and I think that he's already working with the paint. The paint fumes are rising. He's surrounded by these things, and at some point, I think he gets the idea to start like smelling the yellow paint, and it starts to his head. It starts smelling good to him, and it's kind of a slippery slope where it's like, this smells good. I wonder how this would taste. Like, it's a thought process, like, it's like culinary experimentation, but from a person who does not have a good sense on what should and should not be food.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but I will throw this out there. I think that's how all food becomes consumed, good or bad. Like, someone had to sit there and go, huh, these weird things growing in the ground kind of smell good. I wonder what they take. And then they start eating mushrooms, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, And then, like, a couple people died. They're like, well, don't eat those. Like, try these over here.
Cornland in the middle of the Midwest here. And so this is the official time of year where everybody's social media explodes with two things, corn sweat and corn smut. And so for those of you who don't know what the hell I'm talking about, corn sweat, which sounds like some kind of Midwest BS, is actually for real. So basically, if you have areas that have really big cornfields, which, hello, Illinois, we're good at that, you get
That's
enough.
That's amazing.
Sort of oh my God, Patrick Louise, you just did that. So we've got like, if you get like vast acreage of corn, it will essentially off-gas enough humidity as it's ripening that it changes the environmental conditions surrounding it for hundreds of miles. And so August in Illinois is easily the worst part of the summer because the corn is just about ready to be harvested. It's off-gassing an incredible amount of moisture into the air. And so the humidity is just sky high all the time. It's corn sweat. But corn sweat.
I would like to know if there's a similar effect in Gilroy with all the garlic.
Maybe.
Ever been to Gilroy, Sam?
The air smells great if you like garlic.
If you like garlic, yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, not so much. But yeah. I like garlic, so I thought that the air smelled nice in Gilroy.
Well, then, the other one is go to Bakersfield. Yeah. Go to Bakersfield.
I don't want to say anything bad about Bakersfield, so. Let's move on.
It smells like cow patties. Corn smut.
Yeah, so corn smut, if someone Googles this, I apologize, but it looks sort of like it came from another planet. Corn smut tends to happen around the same time as corn sweat. It's a fungal infection of ears of corn that you generally notice once you start peeling the corn itself. And it basically, like the individual kernels just blow up and turn gray and kind of misshapen and strange. And the native Mexicans referred to it as like huicochle, I think is the name. I'm probably mispronouncing that and or misremembering it. The Midwesterners just call it corn smut because why not? And you can carve that stuff off and chop it up and eat it. And it's considered a delicacy. It's supposed to taste like what happens if corn and mushrooms are sort of mingled together. And it is 1000% an example of that kind of someone looked at that and was like,
no,
I'm going to eat it.
No. I'm sorry. This is coming from the land of Malort. We're not. No.
I'm not a corn smut aficionado myself.
I mean, but that's totally a thing. Like there's that. I think it's like an Icelandic dish or something like that, where you take a shark and you bury it and you wait for the shark to ferment, and so it's like this weird ammonia laden fermented shark thing, and apparently it has a smell similar to gasoline, but apparently that's it. Like someone had to think of all these steps to somehow make this otherwise inedible shark edible and then make this weird gasoline tasting food out of it, and people decided that's a delicacy. So I mean, people will eat all kinds of things.
Yeah, people will eat black licorice, so I'm just saying.
I always wonder about the first person who, and again, I get the people are really hungry, but who, you know, who pulls like a lobster up from like, you know, deep in the ocean. They're like, this is some kind of gigantic insect monster with these gnashing, like this thing looks like,
bite me. Yeah.
It's like, this thing looks like a demon from hell. I bet it's good eating though. Like, yeah, you know,
maybe got some butter.
like
see how this bad boy goes down. Yeah, I mean, there are so many aspects, I think, of if we just kind of slow down a bit to think about human culinary experience, human experience of drugs and medicine and developing societies and all sorts of things. Like, going back to the idea of drugs, like there's the infamous types of frog that exist in the Amazon basin and other places that exude hallucinogenic psychotropic compounds.
Oh, yeah. Their skin.
At some point, somebody picked up that frog, felt a little bit weird, and was like, hey, Joe, lick the frog. I promise.
That was a dare.
I assume it was like some kind of Amazonian fraternity prank.
Yeah.
Or like initiation thing. It seems 100% like it's what you would do during rush week. Like somebody's passing around the frog and then the pledger's got to do a thing.
Yeah, especially given that I think those same regions often have like, you know, they've got those poison arrow frogs that were used by indigenous people because their skins have incredibly potent venoms in them. So it's like, hey, I'm licking this and I feel kind of funny. Am I about to trip or have I poisoned myself irreversibly? Like, you know.
Yeah. And then they're like, whoa, that's the irreversible poison frog. Let's figure out some way to get arrows tipped with it, but also not die while doing it.
Yeah. Like that one is at least almost, I feel like it takes more effort to figure out which ones you can actually lick and not have like a horrible experience than at least with the poison one. You can kind of watch other stuff like, oh, something's eating, but it's hard to see. Okay, something ate that frog, and now they're like wreathing around. Is that good wreathing? Is that bad wreathing? Like, what exactly?
Yeah, it's a little bit hard to tell if an animal is tripping.
I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, can't really ask.
It's funny that you bring up the Amazon, though, because very, very early on in my podcasting, I got to interview the author of the Footprints of the Gods. It's like he's like an archaeologist that other archaeologists don't want to be around.
Mm.
And he had written a fiction novel. And so I was like, oh, you know, where did the idea come from for this fiction novel? And he said, well, I was in the Amazon doing drugs with the elders. And the idea just kind of came to me and as I was tripping. And so I had to go back several times to do it again so I could get the full story. And I'm just sitting there going,
this is like 3 years ago or something. I couldn't make an episode, and you were recording solo for a couple of episodes. And there was a dude who went to Burning Man.
Yep.
And he had gotten very altered there. And that was the origin story for his novel. So yeah, I guess it's super appropriate that you're here, Sam, because the work that you have researched marches onward to influence other creators today.
No, absolutely. And it's amazing when people can get the, so he didn't invent it, but I'm pretty sure that the reason that Steve Jobs adopted the graphical user interface that we now are just take for granted, like we don't usually think of computers or even phones without icons, right? Like, you know, it's the idea of not having little pictures to click on. But when Steve Jobs was like working in the industry initially, the industry standard was just plain text on a plain background. And so I think Xerox had developed the graphical user interface like, oh, hey, if you want to get rid of a file, you put it in this little trash can graphic. So they think about that and they're like, you know what? No, this is too gimmicky and childish. This feels almost like one of those, you know, you click on the pig and the pig goes oink. You know, the cow goes, it seems almost like a child's toy. Whereas Steve Jobs had been tripping on LSD. And so he's in a state of mind where he is thinking differently, as the old slogan went. And so he's thinking, no, we're going to make the computer like a little room and people are going to go inside this. It's going to be a space where they're existing and they're going to throw away files in a trash can because that's actually like they're inside the room and the whole thing is going to be interactive. And so that was the kind of thing where it seemed just like the ramblings of a weird, like hippie counterculture stoner guy. But then that becomes the industry standard.
Because Microsoft stole it.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Follow the leader. You know, it's like once people see that the graphical user interface does not come off as childish, it comes off as much more visually interesting than simply plain text. Then all of a sudden, everyone wants to do it. But again, that was a squandered opportunity from Xerox, because Xerox could have been the ones who were known for that. But I guess they just weren't tripping hard enough.
Yeah. They need to really kind of lean in a little bit more.
Yeah, no, it was that weird mindset that Steve Jobs was in that helped encourage it. I love that. I think it was on a security clearance for the U.S. government thing, for Apple to get approved to do government work, where he said, oh, yeah, I used to smoke a lot of pot, but really it was the acid was my favorite stuff. Like acid is one of the two or three most important things I've done in my life. And I'm pretty sure that was a government form he said that on.
Yeah, they might have slowed down a little bit there and said, like, can we do another pass on this Steve guy? just to be real, real.
I'm pretty sure he got approved, too. So yeah, it's like,
I mean, at a certain point, they're like, we kind of need him.
Like, at that point, he was financially successful enough. It's like, look, he's a proven, like, he's a titan of the industry. So we're going to look the other way about the fact that he is blatantly pretty much endorsing LSD here.
Well, apparently, you know, not the only multi-billionaire successful person in government who may or may not have been tripping balls quite a lot in the not too distant. But, you know, we'll leave names out of it.
Yeah. Let's leave out the names of living people who can sue.
Yes. That always seems like a...
If they're actually listening to us, they can fucking sue.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm just like, hey, they're listening. Woohoo!
Thank you for stepping on me, says Patrick. Wow, that was a journey right there.
Wild.
So I do kind of want to drill into something that, I don't know, this algorithms are fascinating things, right?
Yeah.
And so I've spent some of my morning before we got together to do this interview kind of Googling around and checking out stuff and whatnot. And I found that the breadcrumb trails that if we go to different online vendors, including, you know, the Bezosaurus's site and so on, that get someone to human history on drugs are really interesting, because the breadcrumb trail through line always seems to be books, humor, then humor again, then self-help and psychology. And so I'm really, I'm kind of interested in, like, having seen my own books and books of people who I have worked with and whatnot threaded in different ways, I've sometimes looked at them and been like, for real? Really? That's not, huh. I don't know that I would have done it that way. And I guess for that breadcrumb trail of humor, entertainment, self-help and psychology, What's your Venn diagram here? Now that you have done the thing and look back on it and are beginning to have a sense of how people are responding to it, what is it that you want people to come away with from this book?
You found, was my book classified as self-help?
I'm looking at it right now. Yeah.
That is peculiar.
I don't know that there's anything that you could do about that, but, you know, just FYI.
No, that is interesting, because I definitely think that there's, obviously my goal is to both entertain and educate, but I'm not really telling people to, like, my main goal with this book is to present the idea that drugs are tools. They are not inherently good or bad. It is about awareness and education and how people use things. And so obviously there are different types of tools, like a butter knife is a tool and a chainsaw is a tool, but it is way easier to mess someone up with a chainsaw or mess yourself up with a chainsaw than it is with a butter knife. So not all tools are the same amount of safety, but generally speaking, I think that these are... pretty much all drugs can be used in ways that are helpful and are harmful. And it's a matter of finding out what the proper circumstances are. So maybe someone could say that as self-help, but I'm pretty clear about the fact that I don't necessarily, depiction is not endorsement. I'm not saying that people should look at the people in my book and say, oh, well, things seem to turn out okay for them, so I'll try and live my life like they did. That is definitely not my intention. I don't want to glorify. I don't want to demonize. I want to share the fascinating true stories of the real human beings that these seemingly larger-than-life historical figures were, and share the nuances and the all too human elements of their stories.
Fair. So I will say you get big prizes for having some of the more fun chapter titles I've seen in a minute. So
thanks.
Well done there. I don't want to leave the audience hanging there. So I'll tease a few of them for you here. Alexander the Great was a sloppy drunk.
Oh, yeah.
So let's see.
René Descartes was a drunken fart.
William Shakespeare was a stoner. George Washington's terrible teeth, which, you know, that's a teaser if ever. Samuel Taylor Coleridge's trip wore off, which is also hilarious if we think about that in terms of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner and it being a journey pun there. So well done.
Oh, yeah. That guy was super, super into his opiates.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. One of my favorite ones was, and it took a little bit of thinking to come up with this, was one of the only ones that actually has living people in it, because they were very cool about this and have been very much on the record, is the Beatles one. Because, you know, again, like both Paul McCartney and Ringo have been open about the fact that, yeah, we did drugs. Like, this is not a secret.
I'm looking at the chapter title right here.
Yeah. So I liked... So Sergeant Pothead's Loaded Hard Drug Band, a.k.a. the Beatles. I was proud of that one.
That one's for you, Patrick.
I'd be quite prepared for that eventuality.
All right. So that's a lot of things. That's a lot of things to enjoy and to love, which means that we're in a pretty happy place right now for Picks of the Week. So Picks of the Week, Patrick?
We'll get to Picks of the Week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, Picks of the Week.
So, Patrick, what's bringing you joy, or the anticipation of joy, or the hope of joy? Or
well, it's funny you put it that way, because I told you what it was before we even started recording. I'm excited because the NFL preseason has started, and I do enjoy sports ball. I am a sports ball fan. There's a couple of different sports balls that I am a fan of. NFL is the major one, but I also love baseball, and I love basketball. So, yes, the NFL preseason has started with a bang. Like the Browns game, there was a fight and like it was bad. And then the Lions game, someone got hurt really bad.
I saw
Had to be taken up. And like both teams just like stopped and just let the clock run out because it's preseason. And I think the Lions were up by like 17. It was something stupid. But we have a patron called Todd. And I sent Todd a thing a couple of days ago, and I'm like, yeah, the preseason has started, so now there's going to be football between now and February every single week. So I'm gearing up for that. It brings me joy. I'm very excited about it. And that's my pick this week, the NFL preseason.
Very nice.
Yeah. Fantastic. So how about you, Sam?
I'm pleased that there's a decent crop of, I'm a fan of various like cartoons and video games and comics and stuff like that. So I was pleased with the current crop of superhero films that came out. I thought Superman was great. I saw Superman twice. That was a lot of fun. And I thought, now to be fair, I did go into it with kind of low expectations, not Superman, but Fantastic Four. I was just hoping, like, I'm like, please don't screw things up again like you did the last two times. And they didn't. It's like, hooray. Like, they kind of, like, I found it enjoyable. It's like they didn't represent people in ways that I didn't cringe at anyone's portrayal once in the movie. I felt that there was like, hey, this is true enough to the characters. So that was satisfying. And as always, I'm still – it is amazing how much longevity Stardew Valley has as a game. Yeah. I think I've clocked like about 840 hours of playtime at this point. And again, within the past like few days, I encountered new stuff that I hadn't seen before. It is astounding how much they can manage to fit in to a video game, especially given that that game is mostly the work of a single person.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Here's my take on Fantastic Four. I have not seen the movie. I'm at that point where I'm at the same point where I was in the beginning of the MCU, in that like Iron Man was not one of my favorite characters. So I was just like, well, I'm gonna go see it and see
what
I'll do. And Fantastic Four, I did not collect Fantastic Four. unless I had to, unless Marvel forced me to with a massive crossover.
Yeah.
And the only times I really saw the Fantastic Four was when they would cross over with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, Peter and Johnny were friends and they would pull pranks on each other. And all
yeah.
And that was like the only time. So like going into Fantastic Four, I'm like, but at the same time, I'm going, well, maybe it'll surprise me the way Iron Man did and then start something new and cool. So I haven't seen it yet and I haven't seen Superman yet, but that's just because I don't want to go to the theater. I'm cautiously optimistic about both.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I felt that, like it did kind of seem with Fantastic Four, like they had a very big list of, we did these things wrong in the past. We need to check off, like, do this right this time. And so there were times when like maybe the plotting felt like a little bit like light, but at the same time, it was just satisfying to see like a character check, a character re-railment. And it was also nice that it was one of those films that you could go into and not have to have seen, like, I liked Thunderbolts, but to be fair, to understand who the characters were, you had to see like a half dozen different movies previously. And with the Fantastic Four one, you can just go into it with very little knowledge and it makes sense.
Yeah. They are running into the problem with the connective tissue.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely, I think they've done a good job at sort of putting context clues. So even if you don't necessarily recognize everyone in a Marvel work, you can still get along. But there was a while where it seemed like you had to do like superhero homework in order to enjoy the next thing. And so I'm glad they're moving away from that.
It's a barrier for what I would consider to be the casual fan who came into Marvel from the movies.
Yeah.
If you, I always say this, if you were a comic book fan, if you grew up on the comic books, none of this is surprising. None of this is work for you. It's just the way Marvel did things. Everything was connected. And the problem that Disney has right now, and I'm sorry, Tracy, we're going long on this, but the problem that I think that Disney has as a whole right now is that they're taking the same approach with Star Wars and with Marvel. And they're doing all the connective tissue. So, you know, if you sat down on Disney Plus one night and Ahsoka popped up, you'd be like, oh, there's a new Star Wars show, and you start watching it. If you never watched Clone Wars, you had no clue who this character was. None whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just a very popular character who is not in any of the main movies or the spinoffs that exist so far. And even with the spinoffs, like to be fair, and I mean no disrespect to the people at Star Wars, but I kind of stopped caring after I fell asleep in the theater during the last two movies that I saw. I fell asleep during Rogue One, and I fell asleep during Solo, and after that, I just kind of stopped seeing Star Wars films, and because those movies were very loud, and I wasn't even that tired. My brain just kind of turned off, and I'm like, I don't really care about what I'm seeing. And so it just kind of got hard to follow, especially when Rogue One's entire thing was like they made an entire movie to wrap up one plot hole about why the Death Star is so easy to blow up. Yeah. And it's like the entire film exists for that. And it's like, oh, gee, I wonder if I can get attached to all of these characters who never make any appearances in any other work. So I know they're all going to die in the end. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough sell. It's a tough sell. Oh, man. So, all right. For those of you who've been listening to us chatting about Sam's book, Human History on Drugs, and thought to yourself, that sounds like weird historical things and offbeat stuff. It's none of my thing. I have been reading, actually entirely by coincidence, a book that is very much in that same wheelhouse. It's called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything by Dr. Linda Kang and Nate Peterson. And it is written hilariously, thoughtfully, with solid research, and it's split up with different types of substances, from arsenic and antimony to, you know, cocaine and laudanum and many others.
Oh, yeah.
You know, electricity, leeches, cannibalism, all sorts of things that people would do
in
the interest of trying to treat and cure illnesses that undoubtedly made them much, much, much sicker or even dead.
My uncle's mother swore by kerosene.
That was a thing.
At all. Yeah. Oh, you got a cut? Okay, here, put your entire leg in this kerosene.
It's wild. I mean,
is how you know it's working.
Yeah. There's certainly some stuff like that in my book. Like, again, because Freud thought that cocaine was not addictive, he believed that you could treat morphine addiction by replacing the morphine with cocaine and then abruptly discontinuing the cocaine. Just pow. Turns out that's a terrible idea. Yeah. Turns out that does not work at all.
Yeah, the brain doesn't really like those sorts of swings very much.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and again, I'm pretty sure that at one point he thought that he could cure, like, I don't know, like a sinus infection, or at some point he basically had someone stuff cocaine into their like nasal cavity until it collapsed. So, again, not he was not a great doctor.
Yeah, gonna have to be happy about. His methods not surviving into then again, I don't know, man. With Robert Fluoride Kennedy in charge, we'll see where the medical establishment is in a couple of years. We might be talking to you about a very, very different project then, Sam.
Yeah. It makes me nervous that there's people of the sort of like the precious bodily fluids Dr. Strangelove kind of ilk in the government, making policy about things that they really don't have any expertise on and probably should be far away from these things.
Oh, well. So in the meantime, while we don't, for the limited period of time that we're not living in opposite world and we can appreciate things in context with some nuance and some curiosity and a sense of humor, people should be checking out Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence by Sam Kelly. Sam, where can people find you and the super cool things you do?
Yes. So I am on TikTok as Human History on Dergs, because apparently you can't say drugs on TikTok, but if you move two of the letters around, that's okay. If they're trying to prevent people from selling drugs, couldn't they just claim they're selling Dergs instead? I don't really understand how that. Anyways, Human History on Dergs on TikTok. And then on Instagram, it's Human History on Drugs, just spelled the normal way, because they don't subscribe to the whole like switch the letters around, but it's magic. It's a talisman to keep away drug dealers. But yeah, so I'm on TikTok and Instagram, and you know, my book is available at all major booksellers. You can look up Human History on Drugs, Penguin Random House, and it'll have a list of, if you want to support your local bookstore, you can find that there. You want to buy it from a big box retailer, you know, you can do that too.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really fun having you, Sam.
Yeah, it's been great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.